Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. And this week we are venturing to the Unbound universe. We're going to have a look at Doctor Who Unbound, a range that Big Finish has kind of had on and off for about 20 years now. There aren't a lot of releases here. It's spun off into other things, but we're looking at those earlier releases. We're looking at the sort of initial run and then two follow-ups that came along. So we're going to do some in this episode, and then we're going to do some in a future episode, but by the time we're done, we will have covered all of those original Unbounds. So we're going to look at two sort of alternative doctors today, two Unbound doctors. One of them is Geoffrey Beldam, and one of them is David Warner. And to look at these doctors, I've got a few other podcasters with me. I've got Gareth. Hello, Gareth.
Hello there.
I've got Jimmy.
Hi.
And I've got Mark.
Hello.
And we've got some really good stories to get through today. We're going to do the two Geoffrey Beldam ones first. So we've got Old Mortality and A Storm of Angels, because Jimmy's joined us just for those. You're a big fan of this Doctor, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love the original Hartnell Doctor, of course, and so a different spin on him was always going to be something that was going to appeal to me.
And it's very well cast. He's very much the first Doctor, but not our first Doctor, and I really do like how that works so incredibly well.
Yeah, and especially considering he was originally considered for the role back when the show actually started, and then considered again for the five Doctors. And I mean, I wouldn't want to lose Hartnell's performance, of course, but I would have loved to have seen him in the five Doctors. He would have been brilliant based on these audios.
I can absolutely see why he was a contender for that, yeah. So before we dive in, I'm going to go round each one of you and ask what your favourite Unbound story is. So this is from that first run and kind of the two follow-ups that we're also looking at today. So Gareth, do you want to go first? What's your favourite Doctor Who Unbound release?
Of the four we're doing today, definitely Old Mortality, I would say. We'll get into it, but I've always kind of felt like it's a sort of ersatz anniversary special. Like, no particular anniversary, it just really feels like a sort of celebration of Doctor Who kind of thing. Like, it's really just about the general tenets of it. And I always come away from it, especially the last couple of minutes, just feeling quite good about the whole show, really. I think it's quite special in a lot of ways. We'll get into it, but yeah, that's the one, I think.
It's definitely a good one. Jimmy, I imagine you're going to have a similar answer.
Well, actually, I know a lot of people prefer of the two Beldam ones, Old Mortality, but I actually personally love A Storm of Angels. I mean, Old Mortality is brilliant, but A Storm of Angels just narrowly pips it for me.
I think it does some really sort of wonderful stuff with Susan that I can see why would push it across the line. I get that. What about you, Mark?
I'm also like Gareth, it's Old Mortality for me. Not just of the four we're talking about today, but out of all the Unbounds, I think it's head and shoulders above the rest. I just think it's one of the best things Big Finish ever did, never mind the Unbounds. I think it's just one of their finest stars.
Just to piggyback off that for a sec, I definitely agree. I tend to use this as an example of I kind of find Mark Platt a little bit hit and miss sometimes, because I find that sometimes his ideas, I can't really get on board with them. Like, sometimes he's always got loads of ideas, but sometimes I can't quite get to the middle of them and sort of figure out what the story is. And this for me is, and not to say like, you know, Storm of Angels isn't good, but this for me is always kind of my example in Big Finish of like, well, sometimes I find it, you know, just perfectly works. So yeah, just banger.
Yeah, no, I agree that it's certainly the best thing I've ever heard written by him. He just plays a blinder with this one. So I look forward to talking about it a bit more.
You see, I'm coming straight in with a different answer now. Mine's always been Sympathy for the Devil. I think it's an absolutely wonderful story, and it's a little bit continuity reliant, certainly not as continuity reliant as other Unbound releases, but that is for another day. But I quite like what it does with, you know, the Brigadier and the idea of the Doctor being exiled to the wrong time, and it sort of plays into events of the Mind of Evil have occurred, but without the Doctor there, and we get an absolutely fantastic Master out of it. And I do love the David Warner Doctor, and this is his sort of origin story is absolutely wonderful. And I really, really like the fact that it just holds such a wonderful doomy atmosphere all the way through. It just feels like it's building to the disaster that it eventually does build to. It's very well done, but again, we'll discuss it more later. Let's go straight to Old Mortality then, which we've already said a little bit on, but let's expand. You go first, Gareth.
Okay, so the what if here is probably, because that's kind of an underappreciated thing of these releases. You can enjoy them just as stories, but they also aim to have like a what if jumping off thing. So for this one, it's what if the Doctor never left Gallifrey? And I think it does a very interesting job of not just sort of having that as the premise, but interrogating it in the story. So it goes, all right, what would he do if he didn't leave Gallifrey? And why wouldn't he? Like, what would have happened to him to kind of prevent that? Because I think we can take it as read that it's in his nature to go, so he shouldn't want to stay. So yeah, he becomes this author, which I think is a kind of wonderfully sort of not immediately obvious thing that the Doctor would do with his time. But at the same time, because Doctor Who is such an institution of storytelling, that kind of feels in a meta way like perfect. Like, of course, he'd, you know, if he's not having adventures, he'd want to be kind of vicariously having them. And the story of why he hasn't left Gallifrey becomes this kind of heavy Gallifreyan lore thing, which obviously leans into Mark Platt's perhaps less readily accessible adventure, Lungbarrow. But on that subject, I would say, I heard this long before I read Lungbarrow, and I don't think there's any required reading in this. I think it's very much, it kind of takes the kind of weird, fustery atmosphere of that particular book and just brings that to life quite well. You don't need anything. You know, the Doctor's got this strange robot butler called Badger. Yeah, that's an absurd enough idea to just kind of play with straight away. You don't need to go, well, we set that up in the book. Yeah, and Susan is on the periphery as well. She's the president of Gallifrey now. I think that's correct. I've not heard this for about a month now. But yeah, they've got this whole relationship kind of a little bit strained. And you get to see sort of what their relationship would be if he'd not left, what would happen with her. There's, yeah, I just think it's a very interesting example of kind of sort of dropping the stone in the pond and kind of following the ripples and going, you know, the what if, how far can you go with it?
Yeah, it immediately sort of jumps on that idea of what if he was still on Gallifrey. And it's not the take I'd have come up with, I have to admit. Like, I'd have had the Doctor sort of not hiding away and being a bit of a hermit and a writer. I'd have had him getting stuck in and being iconoclastic and basically being the Doctor that we see when he does visit Gallifrey. But yeah, it's a really sort of unique and wonderful, interesting take. Jimmy, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think this story just does such a good job of everything it sets out to. I mean, the premise of the Doctor being stuck on Gallifrey and having wanted to leave but never got to do it, and seeing this alternate spin on him is just, it's just amazing the way he still wants to explore the universe. And so he's doing it through creativity and imagination rather than through actual travel. And the whole time he's, you know, he's actually celebrated and beloved, and they want him at presentations, and he's, but the Badger is stopping it from happening. And seeing Susan come in and shake his life up and turn it back around is just, it's such a good dynamic they have. I mean, I love the original first Doctor and Susan, of course, but this different take on it where Susan's a bit older and wiser and she's about to become the president and meeting the grandfather who she hasn't seen in possibly centuries, and they still just hit it right off, and he's instantly loving to have her back there, and the joy in his voice when he hears that she's got her own grandchildren and he's a great-great-grandfather. It's the performance they both give is brilliant, and of course, for Susan, it's the first, I think it was before the Companion Chronicles that this came out, so it was her first return to the role, and she just picks up this similar but different character perfectly, and Baildon is incredible. I mean, I know it's Unbound, and so he's not supposed to be the first Doctor, but, like, if it's an alternate part of the first Doctor's life, then logically he hasn't regenerated, so it's the same character, and whether he was intending to or not, he just, not perfectly, but he does a spectacular job of being the Hartnell style performance. I mean, there's the characterization differences, but the performance is just so pure Hartnell. It makes me wish Big Finish had come around to or accepted the idea of recasting sooner, because I would have loved to hear him as the canon version of the first Doctor. But yeah, it's such a brilliant story, and there's lots of little coincidences listening to it all these years later that are funny. Like, I noticed two things that if the audio was released today, you'd be like, oh, that's a good callback, but it was actually accidental. Like, the way he's, one of his celebrated novels is An Adventure in Space and Time, and of course that became the title of the drama about the creation of the show. And even when he's talking about the lines about different possibilities and so many different paths, he even gets a line about, suppose I've taken a different path, suppose I turn left this morning instead of right. And it's just like, you'd think that was heavy-handed if it was coming out today, but like, it was actual accidental foreshadowing, and I just love it. But yeah, also the story within a story of Hannibal's army marching on Rome, and it's such a good sort of historical thing, but they switch it up, and you know, you've got Cyrus the elephant who can talk, and oh, we'll try this path, but then we'll redo it and take the other path. And it just, yeah, it's interesting to hear the story interact with him. Like, he's supposed to be a writer, and it's like you often hear about people who write being like, oh, the character wouldn't do it, they changed it on me. And it actually happens literally in this case. And it's just such a brilliant ending to the story when, you know, Cyrus and Hannibal and his army storm the Panopticon, and then you get to the bit about the Susan, you know, trying to get the Doctor to turn off the machine. And even after all this time, he's just worried that she's his imagination and she's not real. And if he turns off the machine, she'll be gone, which is excellent foreshadowing for, of course, the Storm of Angels. And so, yeah, I think this story, as much as I prefer Storm of Angels, I absolutely love Old Mortality. It's pretty much flawless. I thoroughly enjoy it.
I have to admit, you're definitely sort of selling it to me. It's never been my favourite, as I said before, and I really need to go back to it and give it yet another go. I've listened to it relatively recently, preparing for this. I think that as I've listened to it in the past, I have taken just a little bit more from it each time. I think that that's, I must obviously need to go back and do it again. What about you, Mark? Talk to us about Old Mortality.
Right, well, gosh, I was trying to think shortly before we recorded how I could adequately put into words what this story means to me, because I listen to this thing like clockwork every, just, you know, close to the anniversary every year. And I don't think I've missed a single year, because this thing has become such a pure distillation of what Doctor Who is, despite being from the Unbound universe and not the prime, you know, canon timeline, as it were. And I think I suddenly hit upon the realization not long before we recorded that it's the closest that a story has ever felt to me, like the feeling of Christmas Eve. Now, I know that sounds like a bit of a strange thing to bring in at this point, but it's Christmas Eve is my favorite day of the year, right? It's the part of Christmas where Christmas hasn't started to begin to be over yet, right? So in other words, the possibility tree of Christmas is still completely intact. You haven't taken a single turn right, left, or any of the branches yet. You know, it's all there ahead of you. And it's this perfect little pristine moment of magic in the year between where ordinary time temporarily stops. You're at the beginning of this bubble of unreality that we all just sit in for the last bit of the year. And there's a particular flavour of magic to Christmas Eve itself and no other part of Christmas, where it's just like, yeah, there's something just pristine and perfect about this. And that's what Old Mortality feels like to me when I listen to it. Now, why is that? I think it's something to do with the fact that if you take those moments in Doctor Who's actual, you know, TV canon or whatever, where they've tried to do, sorry, where they have very successfully done anniversary stories and things of that nature, where the series tries to take a look at itself, it often does a very good job, but it can never entirely give you, if you like, from the outside in, a complete overview of what Doctor Who is. It's total magic, right? Old Mortality can somehow do it by being just a universe to the left, you know? It can look in on what we understand as Doctor Who, but it can also show you, because not one branch of the possibility tree has yet been taken, and yet we see all these things. We even see glimpses of, you know, a foggy night on Barnes Common, and we see, you know, glimpses of the TARDIS spiraling between worlds, and a meeting with Winston Churchill. It's not the one we see on television, and all these different images are. And Mark Platt comes up with some absolutely exquisitely expressed poetic images. You know, torchlight on the canals of Venice, and mystery and intrigue, all of it as yet unexplored, and all of it therefore perfect. Nothing's been compromised yet, if that makes sense. And yet the Doctor is still in this liminal state that he needs to break free of. He needs to begin, you know, he needs to have the Christmas that will be Doctor Who as we know it must unfold, and wrong turns and right turns and imperfections must unfold. He needs to begin to live rather than live in this little liminal space, and yet just being in that, just as a one-off experience with that Doctor who is so close to being William Hartnell, is such a special thing. It feels like the most successful, this is what Doctor Who is, and this is what Doctor Who feels like in terms of its total magic, and it can only do it by not being like embedded in the series itself, where it can't completely comprehend itself, if that makes sense. I'm not sure I've expressed that very well, but hopefully you get some sense of what I mean. But just to take it down to the level of the slightly less abstract and the more just like, you know, elements of the story, I think there's some brilliant things that Mark Platt does here. He brings in this character of Uncle Quences, sorry, Granduncle Quences, who is this kind of like spectral figure haunting the whole thing. And there's all sorts of wonderful stuff. The Hannibal stuff at the beginning is a lovely little sort of nod to, you know, here was the alternative possibility to starting with cavemen, you know, which also gets referenced then later in Deadline as well. And one key component I'll just mention in case it goes out of my head before we stop talking about this, Alistair Locke's music for this thing is perfect. Those initial sequences with Hannibal, he conjures this epic feel of almost like, you know, like those old Charlton Heston cast of thousands epic movies from back in the day, the biblical epics, you know, or things of that nature. And yet when it comes down to the little closeted sort of cozy but trapped existence that the Doctor is living in his little sort of tomb slash house there, you know, there's this very intricate music comes in when Susan first walks into the study and she's exploring all his papers, and you know, she's going through all the places he's visited in his imagination, and the whole thing is wonderful. But there's this brilliant contrast between, yeah, the sort of, and again, this is part of the fundamental magic of Doctor Who, the coziness of that little bubble that he's living in there versus tentative kind of voyages into the unknown and into the cold spaces of the universe, as I think Uncle Quences retreats from. You know, he's like, you know, the place for that is in observatories. I don't want to be out here in the real universe, you know, whereas the Doctor kind of yearns for that. And he catches glimpses of that possibility of himself spiraling between worlds, Anyway, there's so much stuff in it. I can only, you know, get to the tip of the iceberg, really, and I'll stop talking because I could go on and on. But it's a truly special thing, and I can only really conjure a fraction of how I feel about it because it's so good.
I think it's sort of fairly unique, really, for a story to evoke, you know, reactions like this. I struggle to think of anything else that we've done on this podcast that kind of would have the same impact on the listener. And I think that that's something they probably were consciously tapping into at the very start. You know, they had the opportunity to do something big and wonderful and special. And I guess they've kind of really, really hit the nail on the head with it and succeeded. And I guess that, you know, all of the things we've discussed, sort of the wonderful way it's layered and Baildon's Doctor being so brilliant and Carol Ann Ford being so fantastic as this slightly alternative Susan. And it was obvious to revisit and to do a sequel, and we got a sequel, which is, of course, A Storm of Angels. Very, very, very different story, but it certainly has the same heart as Old Mortality, I think, and that's important. You know, this Unbound universe, it sort of has a very, very unique feel that I don't think any of the others do at all, and obviously it having a second story when many of the others didn't perhaps helps that. But yeah, it's such a shame that really we only got two stories out of this Doctor. But let's talk about Storm of Angels then, and we'll go straight to Gareth. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, just first off, I just want to say that was a very incredible observation there from Mark, comparing it all of that about Christmas Eve. I thought that was absolutely, yeah, I think you've nailed it. It's Christmassy.
Oh, thanks very much.
Yeah. No. Fantastic. And I love the way that it kind of defines Doctor Who by showing you a negative in a way. You take away Doctor Who and you go, what's left? And you see the imprint. Ah, I love that. With Storm of Angels, and I'm sure Jimmy's probably got the definitive take on this, given the love he has for it. For me, and I don't mean this to denigrate it at all, the same I would say, spoiler alert, is sort of true for me of Masters of War, is it feels more like a kind of treat or like a victory lap than like a definitive entry in the kind of what if pantheon, because in this one we kind of continue to explore the idea. At the end of Old Mortality, when the Doctor, you know, both does and does not kind of crumble and go, right, that's it, I'm gonna leave, and he goes off into space, and we find his adventures with Susan continuing, and he's on this Elizabethan spaceship, which is all very Enlightenment, which is great, because that coincidentally is probably one of my sort of top three stories from the entire 80s of Doctor Who. Yeah, and they're just having this incredible adventure where it seems that the Doctor is so obsessed with possibility, and he's been kind of, I took away from it that he's been kind of worsened in a way because he's been trapped and he's been forced to imagine so much that he's really not that bothered about history. Like the details staying the same. He's very much like, well, you know, you can give things a little nudge, that's okay. So we do kind of explore, you know, the possibility that the Doctor and Susan could have kind of given things a little prod to the left or the right. And you have this adventure that's, again, to me, it feels kind of just like, oh, it's such a wonderful thing to get four more episodes with these characters. We are insanely lucky. Like, I absolutely agree. You know, in a perfect universe, we would have got loads, because Baildon clearly is the man. I mean, he is fantastic. He's not doing a William Hartnell impression. He's very much just inhabiting the character in the way that he does. But strangely, that's no problem. Like, at no point am I in any doubt that this is the First Doctor. And you've got Carol Ann Ford as well. And she, I think these are probably, you know, like you guys were saying that this was her sort of inaugural big finish. What a landing, because the thing, if you've ever heard Carol Ann Ford speak about, you know, her time on Doctor Who, I saw at a convention thingy last year, met her. She's very nice. The thing she always kind of lands on is that obviously she loves her time in the show. She's very proud of it. But they kind of, they didn't really deliver, she feels, on like the level of progression that Susan could have had. Like she kind of saw the character being a kind of a bigger, grander thing. And the show somewhat boxed her in, I would say, kind of, you know, more of the she's going to twist her ankle kind of thing. That doesn't mean there's no value to that, but maybe it's not what Caroline Ford thought she was getting into. And these two releases are very much like, well, okay, you're not that 16-year-old anymore. What are you? What can you bring to this? And in Old Mortality, you know, she gets to be quite annoyed with him, like with the doctor. You know, she gets to be older. She's got her own business and family. She can't just drop everything and run. She's a bit miffed with him and stuff. Eventually, they kind of make up. And in this one, we actually get a full-on dichotomy of the two. So we get to see a version of older Susan who's kind of living as the younger version. And we get the kind of older version, truly. And they have scenes together. And it's incredible to me because I'm projecting here, I suppose, but I kind of imagine this is very much Caroline Ford being given an opportunity to kind of show off and go like, I'm not just that. I can be different facets of this character. And, you know, I can talk to this younger one in a kind of, you're not naive, but you know, there's more to you than this. And I love the kind of showcase of that for her. But Baildon is incredible here. The thing I think I take away from it mostly though, strangely, is the monsters. Because you've got these angels, which, and Jimmy was saying, you know, this is Old Mortality, for example, is one of those things where you go, oh, that what an accidental callback to the future. We've got terrifying angels in this one, which, you know, one or two of those might have appeared in Doctor Who since then. But they're made of gems, and there's this whole kind of theme of the way these gems operate, and they kind of climb into people's bodies, into their mouths, and the sort of sound of that, and the sort of sound of people kind of drowning on these gems and pebbles is just genuinely upsetting, but in a really, you know, effective way. Because yeah, you've got this kind of horrible, gaudy Elizabethan situation where you've got all these people kind of marveling at this excess and this wealth, but this excess and this wealth is reanimated corpses filled with gemstones, and it's just an unforgettable kind of image. And yeah, it really does set this apart from Old Mortality. I don't think, as much as I refer to this as feeling like a bit of a victory lap, I don't think anybody's resting on their laurels creatively. They're very much going, let's have a full-on adventure for these characters, but let's also, you know, let's do something we haven't done before. Like, let's really make these monsters kind of count as something memorable and horrible. So it's surprisingly grim. I think it just about holds on to that kind of sweetness and possibility of Old Mortality as well, which kind of makes it an interesting mix, because you still have that ongoing question of like, what is the Doctor going to do with his life? Is this the right thing he can do with it? You know, particularly in reference to dilly-dallying with history, shall we say. And Susan still has to make her mind up, which sort of continues that theme from Old Mortality to kind of a more definite conclusion for the two of them. While I kind of feel like Old Mortality for me is more of a kind of a perfect imprint of what a story is trying to say, and this one I would say is a little more kind of typically Doctor Who, because it is the Doctor and companion go off and have an adventure and battle monsters. I think it's creative enough, and it carries over enough of that spirit to feel special. Like, you wouldn't confuse this with another sort of normal run-of-the-mill episode of Doctor Who. So I think it's along with Masters of War, which we'll get to, I think it's about as close as this range comes to feeling kind of normal. But yeah, you're still aware of the kind of specialness of the Unbound universe that kind of sets it apart. Wish we got more, but I'm glad we got two.
I think that It's a Shame We Never Got More is going to be a bit of a running theme as we visit quite a few of these stories. But yeah, completely agree with you. Pretty much everything you've said there, to be honest. It does feel a bit like a victory lap, but I like the fact that we do get to experience one of the adventures that was kind of hinted at the end of Old Mortality. I'm glad we've got that as opposed to just the montage at the end. Anyway, Jimmy, go on, talk to us about A Storm of Angels.
Well, firstly, I'd say that I think it's a clever way they did it with the Susans was that it's not just a follow-up to one of the endings of Old Mortality, it's a sort of follow-up to two, because you've got these two different Susans, the one who stayed with the Doctor and became his companion, the one who remained on Gallifrey to become the President, and so you're not just following up on one possibility, you're following up on two, and that's a clever way to do it. And again, it gives Susan, Carol Ann Ford, such a brilliant chance at getting her teeth into the role. She's got two very different versions of Susan. She's got both of them's dynamic with the Doctor and their dynamic with each other in the scenes where they're together. And she absolutely knocks it out of the park. She is brilliant as both Susans. And yeah, they both actors, her and Baildon, absolutely capture the first Doctor and Susan of this alternate universe again so well. Like, there's so many little lines and bits and pieces that just feel so true to Hartnell and to Carol back in the day. Like at the start, when the Time Lord agent comes after the Doctor and he just sounds so frustrated, and you could imagine that's what Hartnell would have been like if the Time Lords existed in the TV show in his time. And yeah, he's got such a great dynamic with Susan, and they even say it themselves. There's this part where she's like, "Well, how did you ever cope without me?" And he's like, "Fortunately for you, I can't imagine." And it's just so sweet, like, because the dynamic between the Doctor and Susan in the actual show, it's brilliant, but it doesn't get fleshed out quite as much sometimes because of the nature of 60s television, whereas here you can absolutely see the love and the care for each other so much stronger. And yeah, and again, there's the differences as well, like the Doctor being excited about the possibility of mentioning Shakespeare because he's another writer, and the Doctor being a writer. And I think that sort of ties into why he's got such a different attitude about history. He's spent, you know, however many centuries writing fiction about history, and, you know, you can do what you like in fiction. You can pull plot devices, you can change things around. And so when he gets into real history, he's too used to the way he's been doing it. And so that's why he ends up changing things. He's like, "Oh, I can't have done much. We didn't tell Leonardo much about the way technology works. Oh, and we only visited Mars with him once," or whatever. And it's just, the denial as well is so very heartening. Like, there's the bits in TV, like in The Edge of Destruction, where when they all realise something's gone wrong with their minds, and he's like, "Nothing's happening to me, I'm fine." And it's the same in this story about his denial about altering history. He's like, no, this is a parallel universe. It's not me. And yeah, the characterization, it's just, yeah, absolutely perfect. And again, funny lines like the bit when they called the TARDIS a beer barrel, and he's like, "It's a perfectly respectable barrel." It's just, he really captures Hartnell even more than he did in the first story for me. And again, the script, the imagery is so brilliant. Like, you've got Elizabethan spaceships that are steam powered, and they've got telephones in them, but it's just, it just makes such an interesting setting, and it gives you the interesting dynamic with the two different Susans. And I think that's, again, one of the things that got the best handling, like, especially with them swapping places at the end, and the bit where they're like, "Oh, and we can't tell Grandfather," and then you get the Doctor being like, "Yeah, I knew," without actually saying it to them. And it's just, yeah, so lovely. And I think also, again, with the Susans, this story has one of my favourite lines in Big Finish about the different attitudes to changing history than in the main canon. And it's that lovely line of, "When you're ankle deep in tears and blood, you can't let people suffer just because it's history." And I absolutely love that. Like, that's a line that deserves to be in the actual canon show at some point. Like, that was just brilliant. And yeah, there's not much more I can say. I just absolutely love this story, and it's one of my favourites, not just of the Unbounds, but of the entire Big Finish catalogue. It's just, yeah, amazing.
Yeah, I do love the whole stuff about changing history and that different attitude. And that's kind of, it's something that becomes a bit more of this Doctor's identity than it does the normal Doctor, the regular Doctor. And I really like the way that that's something that we sort of quietly explore, which wasn't the original premise, but it's something that we're going to play with here.
The way the angels are all about feeding on desire, and they try to get the Doctor to go with them. And when they ask him about his desires, and his only desire is not to lose Susan, and that's great foreshadowing of how, you know, she's the fake Susan, but it's also just so sweet that the only thing he wants is not to lose her after he's finally found her. So, yeah, that was another thing I just absolutely had to mention, as well as the Doctor's attitude being a bit more blunt than even Hartnell on TV when he talks to Dee about, oh, yes, such a brilliant scientist, so wonderful to meet you. Shame about that astrology nonsense, like Hartnell wouldn't have been that blunt even though he'd be thinking it. And so, yeah, again, another great difference for the character. So, yeah, I just had to mention those because I just realised I forgot. Sorry.
No, not a problem. So, yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, so I must admit this is the one I came revisited with the greatest reluctance, not because I believe it's worse than a couple of others, which we'll get to in time, because it's decidedly not. But I think it is just that thing for me of old mortality does a very particular thing. And that particular thing is, it is that undisturbed Christmas Eve moment that I kind of talked about. And if I could use another analogy, it may be a bit of a strange and oblique one to use, but the film The Neverending Story, I love that film, right? But I was dismayed to discover that they made sequels to it, because I thought, you've absolutely missed the point of your own film there if you're making sequels to that, because it ends in a way where Fantasia is restored and the possibilities are there and you don't telescope them down, you know? Now, I appreciate what Jimmy was saying, that in fact, although one branch of the possibility tree is shown ultimately to have been taken, and we know exactly sort of where they ended up, at least for one adventure, and a few other things hinted at. Nevertheless, some stuff has begun to crystallize there into like, if you like, a kind of run-of-the-mill ongoing Doctor Who. And I appreciate that there's a twist to that. And it's exactly what Jimmy said, where it's similar. There's a kind of a Schrodinger's Susan thing going on still, even within the fork of the road taken. But it still feels like an already slightly compromised thing to what was a perfect one-off. Now, on the plus side, you do get more of Baelden, which is brilliant. And actually, I was reminded when Jimmy was talking there of the fact that they, you know, when he was referring to the impertinence and so on of Hartnell being amped up even a little bit. They take a little, there's one particular little word that Hartnell said a couple of times, which was just, I think he maybe only says it in An Unearthly Child, actually, but he, it's this word insulting. You know, if somebody says something to him that he takes offense to, he'll go insulting. But that comes up a number of times with Baelden, and it almost becomes a catchphrase for him, and I like that. I think it is quite nice to just revisit the dynamic between his brilliant performance and Carol Ann Ford's brilliant chemistry with him, as the closest thing she's had to an actual Hartnell performance since the original series. But yeah, I just feel overall there's some stuff there. It's like Mark Platt will never disappoint in terms of giving you really vivid imagery, almost like fever dream stuff every single time. And that this is no exception. Although I think some of the stuff he uses there, he kind of reuses, in my opinion, a little more effectively in Time Reef. You know, the sort of the spacefaring kind of Francis Drake type ships and all that. But when Gareth was talking, I was reminded there of, it came into my head actually, he was saying that thing about the angels and what they do and the people drowning in gems and so on. It suddenly came back into my head. I hadn't made the association until just there, but I was recently revisiting some M.R. James stories, And one of them, Casting the Runes, has exactly that kind of image in it of somebody's ultimate fate being their mouth is, they're found dead and their mouth stuffed full of pebbles on the beach. And I wonder, did something of that go into Mark Platt's conscious or unconscious influences when he wrote this thing? The more I talk about it, the more I'm kind of slightly, falling a wee bit more in love with the story again than I remember doing so the first time around. But to me, it's very much the inferior entry in the Beilden sequence. But in fact, I wish it wasn't a sequence. That's my point, really. I think really with The Unbinds, I would like it to be one of two things: either a perfectly self-contained story where it sits alone, it says something very specific that is unbound for a reason, or it does what they ultimately did with David Warner's Doctor and turn it into an ongoing run, and even intertwine it with the primary universe. This thing where you just throw like a kind of an also-ran sequel onto the back of it ultimately feels unsatisfying to me. It can still be an enjoyable ride while you're in the moment. And I listened to Masters of War recently for the first time and find it similarly good, but nowhere near as good as the other Warner story. So I hope you see what I'm saying. It's kind of, you got to throw the lever one way or the other, I think, with these Unbounds. But here we are in this sort of, oh, here's a wee second. It almost feels like we're in sort of Peter Cushing second film territory, where it's like, oh, okay, we're doing more of this, are we? But it's not the real thing. But neither is it doing something interesting with not being our universe's Doctor. So, or interesting enough. I don't think it warranted the return, but I can see why Big Finish were tempted to go there again, because Beilden was so good and Mark Black can write really well for him. So, sorry if that all sounded a bit more negative than might have been hoped for. I feel bad saying all that, Jimmy, but I know you hold your own opinion strongly, so it's not like I'm going to sway that. But that's my take on it. I'm less enamored of it, I think, than the rest of you.
I think that it's, I do understand what you're saying. I understand that All Mortality is just this wonderful wrapped up standalone thing. And I think that if they'd have tried to do it again, it wouldn't have worked. For me, this only works because it's a different kind of story with a different kind of premise, and it's simply taking the characters elsewhere. I think that if we were doing a direct sequel, I think if we were, directly following on or doing something even thematically similar to Old Mortality, I think that it would let itself down. I think that, it works because it reaches out to do something different. That's just my take on it. I think we'd better let Jimmy go now. He's stayed up late to record this one because really wanted to cover those stories. So a big, big thank you for joining us, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me. And I look forward to hearing your stuff on David Warner's Doctor, because I do love his too. I just didn't have the time to re-listen and do it justice. So eager to hear your thoughts. Thanks and bye.
Bye, Jimmy. We shall soldier on, and we'll discuss the two David Warner from the original sort of run of Unbounds as well. And this is a bit of a different one because obviously David Warner went on to be pretty much a regular Big Finish Doctor, before he sadly passed away a few years ago. And the stuff that with Bernice Summerfield is absolutely wonderful. We've covered it on this podcast before, and no doubt we'll revisit again at some point as well. It really is just such a fantastic run. But I think that these two original Unbound stories kind of, they do their own thing. They are very different. And obviously the biggest, most notable thing is that we have the Brigadier as the Doctor's companion, but this is an older Brigadier that never had the friendship with the Doctor during the 70s or is it 80s? Ha ha, unit dating. You know, the Third Doctor's era there. This is a Brigadier who was kind of disgraced and forced out and went to live a different life, and the Doctor kind of comes and plucks him out of that life, and he becomes a proper companion, a travelling in the TARDIS with the Doctor companion at the end of the first story, and I can see why they went straight in to do a second one. So as I said, Sympathy for the Devil is probably my favourite of all of these Unbounds. It could arguably be my favourite Unbound altogether. And I think that it really does offer something totally different and unique. It's a setting that we wouldn't normally have. It's a very, very different Doctor. You know, David Warner's supposed to be a version of the Third Doctor, but very, very different from Pertwee's. And we see sort of a streak of recklessness there. And I know that there is, you know, the way the story progresses, there is sort of a build-up of kind of desperation. But in the end, he kind of just leaves events to go very, very wrong. But he's a very good sort of slightly darker Doctor. And I don't think we get that slightly darker element as much when Bernice Summerfield joins him later on. I think that's something that's pretty unique to this and perhaps Masters of War as well. Yeah, I think this is just a great release. Like I said earlier, it really works hard to build up this really doomy, miserable, something's going to go wrong, almost ticking time bomb-like atmosphere. And I think it plays out really, really well. So, Gareth, I'll let you talk about Sympathy for the Devil.
Thank you. I would say it's quite a popular pick for favourite of the Unbounds, at least from the comments I've seen, but I think that makes total sense. I think it straddles a good line between kind of fresh and weird characterization, which is what you want from an Unbound, but also a bit of continuity. So it kind of uses continuity to get you there. And there are good examples of this. You know, Everybody Loves Turn Left. That's very much an example of what if we snip the Doctor out of this, what happens? The Virgin novel Blood Heat, I don't know if either of you's read, that one absolutely does this. That's very much what happens if the Doctor isn't around to help, in that example, a Silurian invasion. So in this one, it's basically just pole vaulting the entire Pertwee era, just taking the Doctor out of that. And the result, I think, is just this incredibly angry story, just where there are moments of just very cathartic kind of rage in it, where the Brigadier gets to just break down a little bit just at the fact that his men have tried so hard to kind of do all of this without the Doctor's help. And it's been too much. You know, they've had people die. There's this, well, they've had more people than usual die, I should say. But they had the Invasion of the Dinosaurs story, for example, where Mike Yates took his men back in time and just they're dead, they're just gone. And it's stuff like that kind of telling us just the absolute horror stories of how things would have gone, and which is so kind of, it's an interesting juxtaposition, because when you say the words unit family Doctor Who wise to people, the first thing that comes to mind for me is comfort, you know, because it's just, oh, what a nice cozy bunch of, you know, soldiers, but in a nice way, where they're all kind of very pleasant and they just have a cup of tea and, you know, shout occasionally, but that's as bad as it gets. And this is kind of just the nightmare negative of that. But it doesn't just extend to UNIT, it's also to the Master, who is played by the mysterious Sam Kiskaart. I don't know how far we go with that, but he's incredible. And there's a great scene where he gets to just rip shreds off the Doctor, just because he's just raging at him, because he's pretty much taken his place. Like, he's ended up being stuck here for all of this time for kind of unrelated reasons. And he's just so angry because he knows that what kind of person the Doctor is. And from his perspective, the Doctor basically phoned it in and didn't help. So that's all incredible. It's great to see the Brigadier kind of put into this position where he's older, he's wiser. And again, it's a little bit of a Susan thing where you know, we sort of don't really see the Brigadier out of the context of his original conception. But in this one, he gets to be, you know, kind of weary, and he just wants to live, and he's trying to cope with all of this misery that's happened to him. And the Master has that as well, strangely. But one thing that I find a little bit odd about it is that it's sort of almost trivial that things have gone this wrong. So, it you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I've heard it a bunch of times over the years, and perfectly might be wrong. But I think it's the case that the Time Lords just, they happened to make him David Warner, Doctor, instead of John Pertwee. So that's one thing. But they happened to land him in decades too late. They just picked a date and they went, there we go, that's where you're going. And that's the critical choice here, I believe. It's just kind of a mix-up of scheduling. And that's enough, because I think the implication is just like, look, Earth is always getting hammered by aliens and whatnot, but for that 10-year period, they really got it, and they really needed the Doctor at that point in history. So, you know, maybe what to take away from that is that, you know, some Time Lord in the War Games looked at human history and went, oh my God, have you seen this stretch of like the 70s or the 80s? It's just one invasion after another. That's where you send him. And in this version of events, that guy just wasn't in that day. So they just went, oh, let's just chuck him in 1996. I don't remember what year it was, around late 90s, the handover. You get this Doctor who kind of, he feels, and obviously it goes without saying, but we'll say, obviously, David Warner is just astonishing in this. I mean, it's very much, you know, where has he been? Like, why has he never done it? He really feels like he's making up for lost time. Which I think is a little bit kind of meta in context, because as a character, he's not. So as a character, he's just turned up and he's like, right, okay, this is all a bit rubbish, isn't it? But hey ho, this is where I'm here. So I feel like the way the character is written and performed is a little bit like the Doctor has sort of knowingly missed out. It almost follows on from old mortality in a way. Because in that one, he's prevented from starting his adventures. In this one, he's, for some reason, been prevented from having literal adventures and dropped off too late to take part in them. But yeah, he becomes this just, I think, whirling dervish is the phrase. He's just this tornado of just activity. And I think that comes to define him through the rest of his adventures. And you know, like we were saying about, wouldn't it be nice if we got some Geoffrey Belden? We are dementedly lucky to have got just an entire range of David Warner. And like you were saying about how that darkness doesn't continue. I think it's there. I don't think it's there as much as it is in this one, because, you know, characters, including the Master, and like, how bad are things if the Master is saying this stuff, but characters are saying to the Doctor, you know, like it or not, this is kind of on you. There are stories later on where we get to see shades of that. I mean, the one that jumps to mind is Planet X, which is in that first set with Bernice, where I think he gets into a situation where he's sort of gassing the baddie or something. He's putting the baddie into this situation like a torture chair or something that they put him in. It didn't work on him because he's a Time Lord. And he ends up in a situation where he's like, well, I don't have to save you. And at moments like that, you kind of go, oh, this guy's a bit different. I do think you see that in this one, because he's just faced with such absolute carnage that he just has to go, right, well, we've just got to do what we can. This is a triage situation. I can't make this perfect. So, yeah, I think it's a very exciting story. There's a lot going on. There's plenty of kind of fun little continuity nods for the fanboys. Literally like the Mind of Evil figures quite heavily into this one. And the fact that the Master is in it at all, I think is quite a big deal. The Master regenerates in it. That's a rarity. I mean, I suppose that gets us out of the Roger Delgado problem. But I think it's a tremendous story. It's just really exciting. It's a great kind of guilty pleasure in the sense of you get to see the mess that would be made. And normally that's undone. So like the examples that come to mind, apart from like Blood Heat mentioned earlier, the movie X-Men Days of Future Past, and presumably the comic, I've not read the original comic, but you get to see multiple scenarios where the good guys are just murdered, right? And they are trying to defeat these monsters and they just can't, and they fail and they fail and they fail. And eventually they fix it, which they don't here. But in that case, you still get to kind of, this is the worst case scenario. I never get to see this because that's what the doctor's for, right? So it's in a really grim way, it's kind of a treat to sort of go, how bad do things get? I've always wanted to know. And I think that's where we get to with Sympathy for the Devil. I think it's a very different sort of treat to Old Mortality, but no less a treat.
I have to admit, this was only sort of partially through design, partially coincidentally. This was actually the story I chose to listen to on the 60th anniversary. I was sort of at a bit of a loose end as what to do. And I know some people had done marathons and planned things, and I always said I would and never did. And then just on the day I thought, what am I going to listen to? And had a playlist that was effectively the complete David Warner Doctor lined up to go. So I just, oh, let's start that then. And obviously this is where that started. And it was a really good choice. It was a really interesting listen in, you know, the context of celebrating Doctor Who. And I think that's because, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. It is kind of the ultimate what happens when the Doctor's not about story. And I think it does do a better job than Turn Left or other things that have explored the idea. And I just think it's excellent.
I just want to say that I'm not Turn Left's biggest fan. I think this one does a really good job of showing you the survivors. We hear from, you know, the Brigadier is critical to that, and I don't think that's Turn Left's job really. But yeah, absolutely, that's something that's really strong here.
Yeah, and of course, before I move on and let Mark have his say, got to mention that David Tennant's in it and is brilliant. As a really, really thoroughly unpleasant, angry character who every single decision he makes just seems to drag the situation into worse and worse territory. It's a really nice alternative sort of David Tennant performance in a Doctor Who production. And I think the same character comes back in Unit, or this, our universe's version of the character, if I remember correctly. Anyway, Mark, talk to us about Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned David Tennant there because this was before David Tennant was David Tennant, and because I listened to it when it came out, this was back in the days when I could keep up with Big Finish's release schedule, I had this image in my head of this guy as a big, like, burly, red-headed sort of Scotsman, you know? And now that I know it's David Tennant, I still can't get rid of that original impression of who Colonel Rick Grimmickham Wood is and how he looks, you know. So there's nothing of David Tennant about him to this day. Even, you know, when I re-listen to the story, I know it's him, but I can only see this guy, you know, which shows you how you know, what a vivid impression the story made on me first time around. I think that phrase you hit on, Gareth, to do with cathartic rage, absolutely hits the nail on the head. That's the kind of fulcrum around which this thing turns. It's like, where did this sort of cozy Barry Letts side of the Pertwee era go if this is our alternative Pertwee? And I guess if it's anywhere, it's in the sort of you know, Zen philosophy or whatever of the monks at the monastery. You know, it's kind of all over there, and everything else out in the world is just nasty and brutal. And in terms of, I hadn't really thought about what you raised there in terms of, well, why did the Time Lords make him arrive late, as it were, when all this other stuff could have been tackled, since that was the whole point of him going there. And it suddenly occurs to me, well, maybe as they knew the Master was marooned on Earth anyway, they probably unwisely thought, well, he can sort of hold the line here, you know. And he did a, you know, the inevitably botched job of that the Master would, because he's not bringing the Doctor's kind of moral certainties to it. And I think that obviously left the Master in a very vulnerable position, and the rage that's built up in him around all of that, having to be the guy that held the line imperfectly, or even more imperfectly than the Doctor would do. The scene that I always end up playing over and over again, like I'll skip back as soon as I've heard it and listen to it about five times over, is the one where he and the Doctor have that real confrontation, where it starts off with going, oh, you know, like, Chairman Mao spoke ever so highly of you, and the Doctor's going, well, he's on the defensive, and he's going, but when I knew him, he was a librarian, and all this stuff. It's brilliant. And then it gets to this point where the Doctor says, look, I haven't been here since the 1960s, and the Master goes, yeah, it shows. And there's just something in that moment that just feels absolutely central to the thing, and that those moments at the end where it is all going to hell, you know, the Doctor's sort of fixed things up to a point, but then as you said, Johnson, he's quite happy to sort of sail off and leave a lot of stuff still kicking off, including, you know, that whole, you know, the helicopters at the harbour at midnight and all that, and so there's a lot of tension left at the end, and it really does feel very high stakes. You know, it's really quite scary, you know, quite tense. I think Warner's performance is excellent. I find him much more arresting in terms of his performance in this one than I later did in Masters of War, which I only heard for the first time recently. But nevertheless, Warner never phones it in. I know he loved working for Big Finish, so he would have turned up to do the smallest bit part or the biggest part. Whatever they asked him to do, he would just turn up because he loved being there, and we were very lucky that he did. Can I just I should probably just wrap up, you know, my little spiel here, because I'm not sure I can. I think you, Johnson, and Gareth, between you, have very comprehensively and articulately covered many of the facets of the story that make it work. So I'm just going to say something quite frivolous at this point, and just say, I like that they got they used a Rolling Stones song title there for the story title, "Sympathy for the Devil." But then they also managed to squeeze a lyric into the actual dialogue, which is at one point the Brigadier says, what is it you're still trying to puzzle out here? And the Doctor goes, the nature of his game, Brigadier, the nature of his game. And I thought, oh, that's from the song. He's got that in. So it's Jonathan Clements, isn't it, that wrote that one? Anyway, I think, if I haven't misremembered. But anyway, I thought that was very well done. Crowbarring that in without making it seem too... Oh, and sorry, one final thing. I remember hearing that originally there was a line in the script that the Brigadier in the pub, working in the pub, was to have said, chap at table three there, five rounds rapid. And I'm not sure whether to be disappointed or relieved that they removed that, but it would have been quite something to hear. So anyway, that's my take on Sympathy for the Devil. So,
have to admit, I'm glad that line never made it in. I absolutely love the, you know, the reference to the song, the nature of his game. I do think that is so brilliantly worked in. But no, we don't need to have the Brigadier say five rounds rapid at every opportunity. But yeah, it really is a wonderful little story, and it's one that I always love revisiting, and I don't have anything negative really to say about it. It's just, I think it is a completely unique Doctor Who story in terms of the way it examines the impact the Doctor has or doesn't have when he's not there, and the way it just handles this constant feeling of foreboding. It is, I know it's a bit of a cliche to say it, but it's like watching a car crash in slow motion, and it's just so beautifully done. And let's move on then. Let's move on to Masters of War, which is this Doctor getting to meet the Daleks and Davros, and it's all going wrong there as well. This is another another sort of fun and interesting story with lots of interesting ideas, and it's doing something different again. It's not just coming up with Sympathy for the Devil 2. It is taking this Doctor and this Brigadier, who are now a TARDIS team, into a totally different situation. And I think it does a good job of, you know, examining Daleks and Davros and their ever-changing and weird relationship. And it sort of has the breathing space to do it very differently. And I think that what really, really does work well here is the fact that David Warner's the third Doctor, and from what we can tell, the first and second Doctor happened pretty much the same way in this universe as they did in ours. So that continuity's there. And I think that's an interesting sandpit to play in. And again, actually, one that I'm fairly disappointed never really gets used in the Bernice Summerfield stories with this Doctor. So talk to us about Masters of War, Gareth.
I'll just start off by saying that's a good point. Strangely, it doesn't come up a great deal in future releases that this Doctor is canonically the Doctor from before. He just had some different experiences after a certain point. But hey-ho, that's for another time. Masters of War, I think, is, like we were saying about Storm of Angels, or I was saying, that it feels like kind of a, it'd be nice to do another one of these, so let's do that. In the nicest way, I think this is kind of the apotheosis of that. Like, I do not dislike this story at all. I have a tremendous time with this. I find listening to it is like the audio equivalent of a really lovely burger and chips, right? It's probably not going to be considered sort of a highly complex or a completely off the wall story, which within the bounds of Unbound is arguably not a problem, but, you know, not ideal. But I really feel like they kind of go, right, we've got this set up now. We've got the Warner Doctor. We've got the Brigadier as a companion full time. What's the thing? What do you do with them? You get one more go at this. What do you do? And to be honest, I think sticking them on Skaro, having them fight a bunch of Daleks, I can think of worse answers than that. I think that's very solid. The story we get, you know, you get to have the Doctor doing his kind of tornado of activity, trying to catch up. And I think the Brigadier even vocalizes that, like, oh, it's like he's making up for lost time. And so he just immediately gets stuck in this kind of awful situation on Skaro. He supports the Thals, and he sees there's this situation with the Daleks. He makes some assumptions, and he kind of goes, right, well, this is terrible. Got to fix this. And he gets stuck in, and the Brigadier gets to use his military expertise, and we get to see a slightly different side of the Daleks. And I think by kind of this point in the sort of big finish run, we're seeing a couple of those callbacks, because it was brought up on a previous release we were talking about here, that one release kind of felt like it was sort of accidentally calling forwards to Doctor Who. This one, I feel like, is kind of accidentally calling back to other big finishes. So I feel like there are notes in here, like the Daleks being posited as, we know they're awful. We all agree they're awful, they're terrible, but maybe there's something worse. That is something that is very satisfying to do. You know, I'm a big fan of Star Trek Voyager. I was very excited when they came along and said, here is something worse than the Borg. I'm here all day for that kind of thing. But Big Finish kind of did that with the mutant phase. I think they later on would do it with Enemy of the Daleks. I think they kind of did it with Dalek Empire. I mean, in that case, it was literally other Daleks from another universe. But it's that kind of sweet spot of going, we're going to find something so dreadful that it sort of puts the Daleks in context. So I'm not complaining. I really enjoy that. But at the same time, I don't really know what the process was to come up with this story, but it feels as though we're kind of not having an Unbound. We're kind of having another go at something that we've already had. And that's where, like, the sort of term victory lap really comes to mind for me. In the moment, it's still tremendously satisfying to me to have Warner and the Brigadier. You know, the Brigadier really getting to exercise his kind of general muscles that he's never, you know, he never really got that far in Doctor Who. Obviously, he's a Brigadier. But he gets to command whole armies and, you know, he gets to make, you know, huge strategic decisions and stuff like that. So you have these huge space, well, I suppose sky battles is more appropriate, but you have these enormous battles going on. So there's tons of action, tons of excitement. I suppose one note that is not perfect is the bad guys, the worst guys, I should say. They are called the Quatch, and maybe I have an infantile sense of humor, but that sounds like another word, you know, said in a slightly silly way. So every time somebody says that, and you know what, I think the reason I feel that way is because David Warner was in the series Nebulous. I don't know if either of you has ever heard that. Mark Gatiss is in it. It is an incredibly funny, kind of loosely Quatermass riff. And it's set on this future Earth where you've got a scientist working in a kind of laundrette who has to solve tiny little weird crises. Anyway, his nemesis is played by David Warner. And in the first episode, I think there's this evil sentient cactus, and I think it's called Quimp. So yeah, it's just a silly little convergence, but that I couldn't help thinking of that every time. And also you've got the kind of production question of how do you approach a monster that is not Daleks, right? It's going to be worse than Daleks, but it's got to be completely not Daleks. You can't do like Cybermen, where you just go, here's a different robot voice. So you have this kind of reedy voice, this kind of strange, kind of odd, you know, not quite there, ethereal sound. And I totally understand why they made that choice. Again, you've got to come up with a not Dalek. But I don't know how effective it was kind of in the moment. You know, it's a bit of a silly voice, but I mean, it's Doctor Who. You have to kind of accept that sometimes you've got monsters that have got, you know, a breadth of voices. I've not even mentioned Davros. He's in this. Technically, I think he's in it twice. Terry Molloy, I think, has just, you know, long since kind of seized the Davros crown. You know, we all love Michael Wisher, but Terry Molloy is really, excuse me, he's really put in the hours. And in this, you know, you get to see a Davros who's, I would not say benevolent, but trying to kind of exercise his ideas in a more like pragmatic way. And obviously he has fallen in with the Quatch. So he's kind of working with them. And he reaches kind of an interestingly cathartic moment when, you know, he realizes that they are responsible in this universe for his, you know, his condition. And yeah, you know, I really enjoy his performance in this. So overall, I mean, it's like an action movie, you know, it's like a really good time at the movies kind of thing. I would absolutely recommend it. You know, I think it is a fun listen, but I think you can kind of feel the what if range, hopefully not permanently, but in the moment had kind of petered out a bit, because it doesn't really feel like it has an individual what if to offer to me anyway. It's very much a what if we carried on this one and just, you know, did a Dalek story. It's a really good one, but yeah, that's where I land on it. It's a good time. I'm glad we got it. I'm even more glad it led to more stuff. But yeah, it's more fun than it is interesting, I would say.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think essentially, I think the what if is, what if we stuck the Daleks into the Unbound range, which has mileage, but I'd rather have seen something else, and I'd rather have seen something. You know how I said Storm of Angels works really well because it's so different to All Mortality? I think actually I'd have preferred something closer here to Sympathy for the Devil, but we can't have it all. It's still a good story, though. It's still a good release. It does it still asks questions. I agree with you. The questions aren't quite as interesting or thought-provoking as everything else in the range. Mark, what do you think of Masters of War?
Yeah, well, I'll try not to repeat any points already made, but I think it is, you know, I would echo that feeling about it when I listened to it. I only got to it. Do you know, I actually bought Masters of War on the CD when it first came out. What year was that? Years and years ago now, right? And for some reason...
2008.
2008, that's when I bought it.
Yeah.
And literally have only listened to it in the last month. So it could be the longest gap between a purchase and a listen that I've ever... And I think what happened was in 2008, I started listening to it, say the first, I don't know, 10 minutes of it, and it just wasn't doing it for me. And I thought, I'll put that to one side, listen to something else, come back to it. Never did until just now. And I think it was that thing of, oh, so it's Unbound. Like, because to me, up to that point, every single Unbound had been doing a thing, you know, a very clear and obvious thing. And that thing was interesting and contrastive and a proper what-if twist, usually on the Doctor specifically. You know, like a doctor that believes, you know, the end justifies the means or whatever it might be. Whereas this thing seemed to be going, okay, we are just carrying on with the Brigadier and the Doctor. Oh, now we're on Scarrow. Oh, I see what we're doing. It's as though Terry Nation had turned in the 15th slight variation on this original idea. Okay, let's see where this goes. Does it become at any point any more interesting than this? I was halfway through it this time and beginning to lose hope that it would go anywhere interesting because it did feel very much like just a generic retread. It could almost have been written by Terry Nation or Nicholas Briggs or somebody who loves those tropes, you know. And then it started doing some interesting things in the second half and I thought, ah, now I see the point. The point was to sort of set it up very conventionally and then have a few twists towards the end where you go, right, okay, the Daleks are not as straightforward, they're a bit more morally complex here than they have been traditionally. That's interesting. There is the Quatch, which is this, the real bad guys of the piece, if you like. You've got Davros having thrown his allegiance in with a completely different species, but he's bet the wrong horse. And then the Doctor becoming a sort of a... almost forging with Davros, one of those it's almost like the Terror of the Autumn scenario where he has his first encounter with his new nemesis, his new regular nemesis, but they end up teaming forces on day one. You know, they end up joining forces to defeat a common enemy, and Davros gets that moment and a moment of self sacrifice into the bargain. So all those things are interesting, somewhat innovative, and I should have trusted Eddie Robson to deliver something like that in the first place rather than lose faith on him too early, because I've always found him a very interesting writer and a very compelling writer. Nevertheless, in terms of those earlier stories having done a thing, this felt like it was doing... Like I kept reaching the moment of going, oh, is this the thing? But that's not really... That feels like a small thing. I mean, that could almost happen in just... an ordinary Doctor Who story where you could take that particular twist on the idea. So like it almost became like, oh, is the Brigadier's thing, you know, where he chooses a place to stay because it's like, okay, the moral is here's a universe in which the Brigadier found his calling somewhere other than Earth and decided just to make the best of somewhere, because you know you will never end up in the perfect place, so you always have to make the best of what you know. At some point you have to choose, and but again, like any of these things could have come up in the prime Doctor Who universe, as it were, and it's like, okay, well, all of that's a bit less satisfying than what we got in those other stories. Did I enjoy it? Less so than most of the... well, no, it's definitely not the worst of the bunch, but it sits firmly in the middle or somewhere in the bottom half of the overall imbalance for me. I didn't find Warner's performance as compelling in this one. It did feel at times as though he was just reading the lines, and that's unusual for him. But other people might disagree strongly with that and say, no, he's never done that in his life. But in this one, I just felt there were a couple of moments where I thought he's just reading the lines to get to lunchtime there, you know, because there's nothing of particular interest in those few initial scenes. But I think as it gets into that second half, it finds its feet. It does a few interesting things, but those things, yeah, they just abide around the unbound, categorization. They warrant a place in the unbound in the unbound universe of universes, but just whereas the others, I feel very clearly fit the mold of what the original brief was. So. Yeah, it's a bit of a mid one for me, as I believe the young people say, mid. But, you know, entertaining enough. I'll not be rushing back to it, whereas I'll go back to Sympathy any number of times, and I'll go back to Old Mortality any number of times. But Masters of War, it could be another 15 years if spared before I go back to that one again. So, yeah.
I'd be tempted to pick it up again in another podcast soon just to make you listen to it again.
No.
I feel as though we've inspired you. I totally get what you mean. It is a bit of a Marmite story. Maybe it's not a Marmite story. Marmite is you love it or you hate it. Whereas I think you've sort of summed it up as it's middle ground, isn't it? It's people... People seem to think it's okay or not that great. I've never met anybody have a really, really sort of passionate opinion about, oh, it's absolutely amazing, it's one of the best, or it's absolutely dreadful. But it exists. I'm glad it exists. It's more Nicholas Courtney, and I will take it based on that, if absolutely nothing else at all. It is more Nicholas Courtney at Big Finish, of which we definitely, definitely never had enough.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah, more Nick was always very welcome, and it's very sad that we've lost him. And look, John Coleshaw does a very good Brigadier. Well, a very good young Brigadier. Anyway, I'm not sure if he necessarily always captures the older voice, but yeah, you can't beat Nicholas Courtney being Nicholas Courtney, and it's a shame we didn't get even more of him. But we're lucky to have had what we did have in terms of. Just one further thing, just what you were saying, Gareth, about the voices of the Quatch, that really tried my patience as well. And it's not so much the silliness of the voices, because as you say, Doctor Who, you're going to get the odd silly voice. It's I'm conscious of my own silly voice as I'm saying it, but it's silly voice combined with taking forever to say something. That can really, you know, that's not like it can be like nails on a blackboard to me sometimes in terms of listening to a story, you know. And they really did, considering they were, you know, in a battle situation or whatever, the fact that they would take forever to say we are under attack and stuff like that.
Ironically, I think that's also a Dalek problem. I don't think it's as much these days. I think Nick Briggs arguably doesn't get enough credit for how much kind of energy he puts into Dalek voices, because when you have a couple of Daleks have conversations these days, it's weirdly emotive. You know, they're always very charged and furious with each other. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, you know, 60s, to an extent the 70s, particularly like Day of the Daleks, the Daleks can talk quite slowly, and it you know, sort of the worst scenes of a Dalek story used to find was a couple of Daleks need to talk to each other. And it's sort of strangely ironic that in trying to come up with a creature that is the anti-Dalek, the worse than Dalek, you end up with the same thing where, and I will say, I do like the kind of creepy little musical motif that happens every time they talk. Possibly it has to, right? Because you're faced with this voice. So you're like, we've got to do something, because we can't just have these two actors in two booths desperately trying not to make eye contact when they're doing this voice. We'll have to put on a creepy voice effect. But it's a bit like when Daleks sort of stuck in a lift, like, how are you? Mm-hmm. Good weekend. It's that kind of thing.
I think that's part of the problem. I stopped picturing aliens and started picturing two really embarrassed actors just trying not to look at each other through the glass and going, oh God, just get to 5 o'clock and get this part done, you know. Something of it felt like that to me, you know. Normally with Big Finish, that's not the case. It could be just that I'm very prone to secondhand embarrassment too easily. I don't know, but I had that quite strongly in places during this one.
Well, that is all we have time for today. But we've had a really good look at these four stories, and I'm looking forward to coming back and looking at the other Unbound. You know, we've still got Full Fathom 5 to discuss, which is very interesting in terms of what it does. We've got Exile and He Jesset Scars, which interesting. So yeah, it'll be good to sort of revisit those. And because it was a range of ups and downs, Unbound, we've talked, I think, mostly about ups today. But there's no denying that there are some in there that aren't as universally beloved. So it'd be interesting to have a look at those next time. But in the meanwhile, I will say a big thank you and goodbye to Gareth.
Thank you very much.
And a big thank you and goodbye to Mark.
Cheerio.
And we'll continue our journey through the Unbound universe very soon. Goodbye now.